Chapter 56. The President sat at the end of a long conference table in the emergency executive offices 300 feet beneath the White House and stared Dale Jarvis squarely in the eye. "I don't have to tell you, Dale, the last thing I need is a crisis during the last few days of my administration, especially a crisis that can't wait until morning." Jarvis felt the tingling fingers of nervousness. The President was noted for his volcanic temper. Jarvis had been present on more than one occasion when the famous mustache, a delight of political cartoonists, fairly bristled with wrath. With little to lose except his job, Jarvis counterattacked. "I am not in the custom of interrupting your sleep, sir, nor the martial dreams of the Joint Chiefs, unless I have a damned good reason." Defense Secretary Timothy March sucked in his breath. "I think what Dale means..." "What I mean," Jarvis said, "is that somewhere out in Chesapeake Bay there are a bunch of nuts loose with a biological weapon that could conceivably exterminate every living creature in a major city and keep on exterminating for God knows how many generations." General Curtis Higgins, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, gave Jarvis a doubting look. "I know of no weapon with that killing power. Besides, the gas weapons in our arsenal were neutralized and destroyed years ago." "That's the bullshit we give the public," Jarvis snapped back. "But everyone in this room knows better. The truth is, the Army has never stopped developing and stockpiling chemical biological weapons."
"Settle down, Dale."
The President's lips were stretched in a grin beneath the mustache. He took a perverse sort of pleasure whenever his subordinates took to fighting among themselves. Casually, in a move to relieve the tense atmosphere, he leaned back in his chair and draped one leg over the armrest. "For the moment, I suggest we take Dale's warning as gospel." He turned to Admiral Joseph Kemper, the Chief of Naval Operations. "Joe, since this appears to be a naval raid, it falls in your bailiwick." Kemper hardly fit the image of a military leader. Portly and white-haired, he could have easily been hired as a department store floor walker. He looked thoughtfully at the notes he had scribbled during Jarvis's briefing. "There are two facts that bear out Mr. Jarvis's warning. First, the battleship Iowa was sold to Walvis Bay Investment, and as of yesterday, our satellite pictures showed it docked at the Forbes shipyard."
"And its current status?" asked the President.
Kemper did not answer, but pressed a button on the table in front of him and rose from his chair. The wood paneling against the far wall slid apart, revealing an 8-by-10-foot projection screen. Kemper picked up a telephone and said tersely, "Begin." A high-resolution TV picture taken high above the earth flashed on the screen. The clarity and color were far superior to anything transmitted to an ordinary home set. The satellite camera penetrated the early morning darkness and cloud cover as though they did not exist, projecting a view of the eastern Chesapeake Bay shoreline so clear it looked as if it came off a picture postcard. Kemper moved to the screen and made a circular motion with the pencil he used for a pointer. "Here we see the entrance to the Patuxent River and the basin just inside Drum Point to the north and Hog Point to the south." The pencil held steady for a moment. "These small lines are the docks at the Forbes Yard. A point for Mr. Jarvis. As you can see, Mr. President, there is no sign of the Iowa." On Kemper's command, the cameras began sweeping toward the upper end of the bay. Freighters, fishing boats, and a missile frigate passed by in parade, but nothing resembling the massive outlines of a battleship. Cambridge on the right of the screen, soon, the Naval Academy at Annapolis on the left, the toll bridge below Sandy Point, and then up the Patapsco River to Baltimore.
"What lies south?" the President asked.
"Except for Norfolk, no city of any size for 300 miles.
"Come now, gentlemen, not even Merlin and Houdini together could make a battleship disappear."
Before anyone could comment, a White House aide entered the conference room and laid a paper at the President's elbow.
"Just in from the State Department," the President said, scanning the print.
"A communique from Prime Minister Kurtzman of South Africa. He urgently warns us of an imminent attack on the United States mainland by the AAR and apologizes for any direct involvement by his cabinet."
It doesn't figure that Kurtzman would suggest an involvement with his enemy, March said. I should think he'd categorically deny any connection. Probably hedging his bets, ventured Jarvis. Kurtzman must suspect Operation Wild Rose has fallen into our hands. The president kept gazing at the wording on the paper as if unwilling to accept the frightening truth. It looks, he said solemnly, as if all hell is about to break loose. The bridge had been his only miscalculation. The Iowa superstructure was too high to pass under the one man-made obstacle that stood between Fox and his target. The vertical clearance was 3 feet lower than he'd reckoned. He heard, rather than saw, the plywood gun director housing being torn off the forward gun control platform as it smashed into the overhead span of the bridge. Howard MacDonald slammed on his brakes and skidded to a sideways stop, toppling stacked crates of milk bottles in his delivery van. To MacDonald, who was crossing the Harry W. Nice Memorial Toll Bridge to begin his regular milk route, it appeared that an airplane had crashed through the supporting girders almost on top of his truck. He sat there for a few moments in shock, his headlights illuminating a huge pile of debris blocking the two narrow north and southbound lanes. Fearfully, he stepped from the van and approached, expecting to find mangled pieces of human anatomy embedded in the wreckage. Instead, all he discovered were splintered sheets of gray-painted wood. His initial reaction was to stare at a low, overcast sky, but all he saw was a red aircraft obstruction light flashing atop the main span. Then MacDonald walked over to the railing and peered down. Except for what seemed to be the running lights of a string of vessels disappearing around Matthias Point to the north, the channel was empty.